Welcome to Simoncast, the official podcast of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. I'm John Shaw, the director of the Institute. In Simoncast, we aim to keep the legacy of Paul Simon alive and well through wide-ranging civil conversations.
And we're really delighted today to be joined by Miles Rappaport, who is the executive director of an important new group called 100% Democracy. Miles and his co-author E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post published this really important book about a year ago called 100% Democracy, in which they make the case for what they call universal civic duty voting. So we're going to talk about that, their proposal, at some length. A bit about Miles's background. He's a native of New York, graduated from NYU. Early in his career, moved to Connecticut, helped run a group called the Connecticut Citizen Action Group. And then he jumped into electoral politics, was elected to the Connecticut's House of Representatives, where he served for five terms and served a term as Connecticut's Secretary of State. In both cases, working a lot on election and voting issues. He's been president of DEMOS, a really important liberal advocacy group, for 13 years from 2001 to 2014, and then was president of Common Cause for several years after that. In addition to working for 100% Democracy, he is the senior practice fellow in American Democracy at the Ash Center at Harvard's Kennedy School. And Miles is joining us from his home in West Hartford, Connecticut. So good morning, Miles.
Good morning, Jack. Great to see you. Thank you for having me.
Great. Well, Miles, tell us about your kind of interest in politics. You grew up in New York. I know you studied political science and I think economics at NYU. Did you come from a family that was politically interested? Was that always sort of the kind of the primary passion you had growing up?
You know, my parents were not that politically active. You know, they were good, solid kind of liberal folks. But actually, it was kind of the turmoil of the civil rights movement and then the Vietnam War that really got me feeling it was the spirit of the moment that, you know, you had to make change in the world. And that was the most important thing you could choose to do in your life. And so I chose it. And, 50 years later, I'm still at it.
Well, let's talk about your foray into electoral politics. I think it was in 1984 you were first elected to the Connecticut House. As I understood it, kind of a liberal progressive movement, pushing for a progressive income tax and other things. Talk about, you know, the five terms you spent in the Connecticut House and also your time as Connecticut's Secretary of State, which I believe is involved in election issues. I mean, the Secretary of State of Illinois is a very different function, involved more in motor vehicle registration. Right. But so talk about your Connecticut political experience.
Yeah, in Connecticut, the Secretary of the State is the chief election officer. And that's true in about 35 states. So Illinois and New York and several other states do not have the Secretary as chief election official, but I was, and I enjoyed it. So I ran for, as you said, in 1984, which was the Reagan landslide year. So it was not an easy year to begin a political career, but I think I won by 12 votes or something like that. After the recount. But I served 10 years in the legislature, and I did really two things. I was on the finance committee, so I was very involved in trying to push for progressive taxation. But I also was on the elections committee for all 10 years. And then for the last 2 years of my term, I was chair. And, you know, I really got a kind of sense of the importance of making sure that our democracy itself is working well. You know, that it's not separate from issues of environment or issues of poverty and inequality or issues of racism. Whether and how our democracy reflects everyone was crucial. So that was sort of the tack I took as on the committee. And then I continued that as Secretary of the State. I had a little nickname for our office, which was the Advocate in Chief for Democracy and Participation. And so we worked on issues like same-day voter registration and campaign finance reform, generally just trying to make our democracy work better.
Well, in reading some articles about you, the term progressive activist comes up a lot, that phrase. How do you understand that? Parse that term as you think it applies to your work.
Right. Well, you made a point earlier that I want to expand on a little bit, which was that I was a part of what I would call a progressive movement in the state of Connecticut. And of course, there are analogs everywhere, including Illinois. And I think the key themes of what it means to be a progressive in my mind were, one, to fight for more equity and more equality in a society where inequality is kind of rampant. It was rampant in 1984, and it's even more rampant now. And so trying to make sure that we can close the gap between the rich and the poor, and also make sure that we are, facing the issue of the long-term effects of racism on inequality, and making sure that people of color in the country have, genuinely equality of opportunity. And then the second part of it, so those are the kind of economics of it. And then but the second part is to expand involvement and inclusiveness of our democracy. So the issues of making sure that money doesn't have an overwhelming role in our political life, expanding voting rights, making sure that people had more opportunities to register and vote, all those kind of making sure that people had the opportunity to run for office, because back then it was kind of a closed Democratic Party system in the state. So the combination of working for a more equitable future, and I think I would add now a more positive future for our planet. I think the environmental issues are now kind of front and center as well. But the path I've chosen, the lane I've chosen to work at, is trying to make sure that the democracy functions in a way that is responsive to people's needs and encourages their involvement.
Well, in your book, in the author's note, you talk about your sort of penchant for organization and the importance of organizing to advance justice and democracy. Have you always had that bent of sort of trying to figure out, having big book goals, but also focused on the mechanics of making sure that things actually happen and things change?
Well, this is the short version of my life history you're asking, but but it divides into three parts, and I think this is responsive to your question. So the first 15 years after I graduated from college, I was a community organizer. Long before Barack Obama made the term legitimate and well understood. And I worked in Chicago and in Massachusetts, and then eventually came to Connecticut. And what I gained from that was a sense that grassroots organizing and building organizations that can put pressure on the political system is an essential part of making our democracy work in a good way. So then I spent 15 years in electoral politics, still connected to the outside movement and to the Connecticut Citizen Action Group, which I had been the head of. And what I learned from that was that in addition to grassroots pressure and movement from the outside, you also need political leadership that is willing to take risks, move issues forward, and not just kind of go along to get along in elective office. And then for the last, 15 or 20 years, I have been in a kind of a democracy advocate on policy issues. And from that, it is also possible and necessary to think about big ideas, to place them into the public debate, to try to make new issues that don't just sort of come up naturally. And that kind of work of academics and of writers and of thinkers is really important too. So I come away from my whole career with a sense that all of these things are important: grassroots organizing and building of organizations and coalitions is important. Being in politics and having good people who are willing to serve in politics and push the envelope is important. And having people who are bringing new ideas to the table is all important. And all that is part of, I think, making our country work better for the future.
Well, I want to plunge into your big idea in a moment, but in our email exchange, you had mentioned that you supported Paul Simon for president in 1988. Tell us about what you found compelling about Senator Simon's candidacy.
Well, I had spent about 3 years as an organizer in Chicago, actually. I got my Saul Alinsky training there once upon a time, Chicago being the epicenter of Saul Alinsky organizing. And so I was aware of Paul Simon there. Then I moved back to Connecticut. And in 1988, when he ran for president, You know, there were a group of us who thought this is the guy who's the best. He's the most sincere. He's the most committed to an open democracy. He's earnest. He's honest. He's not a cynical politician by any means. And so we supported him. And, you know, I was proud to do so. He didn't quite make it to the presidency, but he would have been a great president had he done so.
Okay. We will save that clip for our files.
All right. There you go.
Thank you.
Well, he didn't get to be president, but he does have a public policy institute named after him. So that's the second best thing.
That's it. That's exactly it. So Miles, let's talk about your book. And the genesis was a working group that you chaired with EJ. And it was called the Universal Voting Working Group. And issued a report called Lift Every Voice, The Urgency of Universal Civic Duty Voting. Talk about that working group, and particularly, did you start out just specifically honing in on universal voting, or did it begin with kind of a broader discussion of democratic challenges, and then you said, okay, this is the one that we want to focus on?
Actually, let me answer by stepping back just a couple of years before the working group was formed. So I figured out that at that time, you know, I had done almost 40 years worth of work on these democracy issues, and including all of the policies that people are now working on to expand: mail-in voting, early voting, same-day voter registration, restoration of voting rights for people who have been incarcerated. You know, there's a whole kind of suite, I would say, of policies. And while I believe that they have worked, and I'm a believer in them, when I looked at where we stand in the United States in terms of turnout, so 2018 was a record turnout for a midterm, and that was 50%. And 2020 was a record turnout for a presidential race, and that was 66%. And if you look at that, you know, I'm glad we had a record turnout, especially within the pandemic, but nothing to write home about. That puts the United States well in the bottom half of, you know, of political participation for industrial democracies. And so I said to myself, all these things that I've worked on for so long haven't moved the needle. Well, they moved the needle, but not very much. And so then I read a piece actually that E.J. Dion had written with Bill Galston for Brookings, which said that we ought to adopt the Australian model of making it a required civic duty to vote. And I said, I had two reactions. One was, wow, this is really interesting and I have never heard about it. And that was the second reaction, which is, how is it that I've been doing this for 40 years and have never, not once ever, been in a conversation about universal votings? So when EJ arrived at Harvard, he had an appointment. I proposed to him that we do this working group specifically to look at the universal civic duty voting. So it didn't start broad and hone in, it started honed in, and this is what we focused on. And the report, you know, got some good coverage and got some attention. It was a terrific group, by the way, with former election officials, constitutional scholars, voting rights advocates, just whole terrifically experienced group of people. And then once we issued our report, we were asked actually by the New Press if we would write the book. And so we both said, sort of twist my arm. So we didn't have to go look for a publisher. A publisher came looking for us. The New Press is a terrific nonpartisan, nonprofit publisher in New York. So we were delighted to partner up with them. And that's where the book came from.
Great. Well, let me read a couple sentences and then have you expand. You and EJ write, "We see voting as a public responsibility of all citizens, no less important than jury duty. If every American citizen is required to vote as a matter of obligation, the representativeness of our elections would increase." Then you go on to say, "Our call for universal civic duty voting is rooted in the proposition that rights and duties are intimately related. To say that everyone should vote is the surest guarantee that everyone will be enabled to vote." And then you'll go on to say, "Voting is a legitimate expectation of citizenship." So start from there and expand, make your argument for universal voting.
Well, we looked at there are now 26 countries, 26 democratic countries around the world that use some form of required voting. They call it mandatory participation, mandatory voting, compulsory voting. I think universal voting is the best description because under the proposal that we make, you're compelled to participate but you don't have to cast a ballot. You can cast a blank ballot. You can write in anybody you want, et cetera. So it's not compelled speech. It's just full participation. And we discovered that in Australia, which has had this for 100 years, which is pretty good proof of concept. And they get 90% turnout in every election. 90% of all Australians vote every time they go to the polls. And that's extraordinary when you compare it to what we have. So, you know, that was the starting point, which is if you believe in a full and as fully inclusive as possible a democracy, this is one way to get there. One really, really kind of North Star leap over all the kind of current debates that we're having and say, yes, everybody's going to participate. And the other thing that I would say is that the analogy about jury duty was very powerful for me, which is, you know, so obviously the first reaction many people have in the United States to the idea that I'm going to be required to vote is, you can't make me do that. I have a right to vote, but I also have a right not to vote. But when you think about jury service, which has been compulsory in the United States for over 100 years, the idea here is that you want the jury pool writ large to reflect fully the population so that people get the fairest and most representative verdicts and punishments. But I think the same logic applies completely to voting, which is we want, or we certainly should want, the decisions that are made by our government, the laws under which we live, and the people who make those laws to be selected by a fully reflective, voting population. And that's not the case now, right? Everybody knows who studied it. Paul Simon would have written about this extensively, is that, you know, the voting electorate is, you know, is tilted in significant ways. You know, young people, communities of color, people with lower education and people with lower income are what are now known as kind of low propensity voters. And so, you know, they vote at much lower levels than richer, whiter, older, and more highly educated people. And so their voices are not heard in the same way. You know, there have been books and studies galore that show that, you know, people, the people who are responded to by government are A, people who are political donors, the donor class, if you will, but also people who vote frequently, like senior citizens. So you have a lot more services and privileges for senior citizens when you compare it to what we have for kids and young people. And that's a reflection in part of the fact that those seniors are going to vote. As a politician, you know they're going to come out. So I think this is a way to make sure that we even the playing field and we even the responsiveness for government.
Well, you also argue that by this universal voting, it would effectively almost revolutionize American democracy, because the way things work now, you know, each party, you know, has its base and does everything it can to energize its base and to discourage your opponent's base from coming out. So your entire campaign is focused on almost narrow casting, you know, getting our people out, discouraging theirs. And when you have a huge electorate, you got to appeal to everyone, and you have to lay out your arguments, and you have to bring everyone along, or at least, you know, 50%.
I think we're going to list you as a co-author. I couldn't have said that better myself. Yes, that's exactly the point. I mean, the currency of the realm today is to enrage, to engage, you know, to get out your vote. I mean, I've heard Democratic consultants, and I'm sure Republican consultants, said the same thing in 2022 in the midterms. This is not a persuasion election. This is a turnout election. If we can just get our people out and parenthetically discourage the other people get out, we win. But in a situation where everybody's going to vote, everybody is always listening. And so what you have to do as a candidate, you can't win just by energizing the 30% of people who agree with you completely. You've got to reach out and get over to a majority position. And I think that would absolutely, I don't want to say absolutely, I don't want to oversell, but I think it would significantly limit the kind of toxic polarization that we have now, because the incentive structure would change. Incentive structure would become, what is it that I can do that will persuade 51% of the people that my ideas or our party's ideas are better, as opposed to how can I get to 31% and keep them down at 30%? And that's what happens now.
Right. Well, you do have a wonderful chapter on Australia. I lived there for a year and a half, so I.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, I'm very interested, and I was aware of their system, but I mean, I learned a lot from your chapter. But I want to read a couple sentences from your talk about the Australian system works. A requirement that everyone has to vote leads not to a dour, eat your peas mood, but to a festive celebration of democracy and its capacity to draw a country together in saluting self-rule. And then you also quote a well-known Australian Labor Party leader, Kim Beazley, who said that when you have this compulsory voting, universal voting, people pay more attention. And even though they may not be dissecting the nuances, they do have this kind of broad sense or this kind of endless questioning about what is in the national interest, what is in the public interest. Respond to that.
Well, first of all, that's right. There's no question that when people know they are required to vote, they both find out about the process and find out about how they want to vote. So that has been shown in Australia and a number of other studies. But what's really interesting is the election, they do everything possible to make it a celebratory civic culture. So the election is elections in Australia are on a Saturday. You can vote pretty much anywhere in the state, you can vote because it's all electronic and you can do that. You don't have to go to your own precinct. And one of the great features is they have a tradition which are called democracy sausages. And what that means is that nonprofit groups at every single polling place around the country serve democracy sausages. And they're very specific. It's a sausage in white bread folded over with onions on the top. And you can actually vote. You can go to Yelp and find out where the best democracy sausages are, and you can go vote there. So it becomes a really celebratory thing. Of course, EJ and I are very careful to point out that we need vegan alternatives. We can't just have it be sausages. So we recommend that very highly. But it is possible to create a culture in which people understand and just as a matter of course plan to participate. There's a funny story that Ralph Nader, who's a very strong supporter of universal voting, said that he was in a taxi cab in Australia. And he asked the person, his driver, whether he found it wrong that he was forced to vote. And the driver turned around and said, "Well, it's my civic duty, mate." And that's sort of how it goes there.
Well, let's talk about some of the objections that have been raised to your proposal. Sure. And the first one, it's just a kind of almost maybe the visceral reaction of a lot of people, which is government compulsion. And people might say, look, if neither party is speaking to me, why do I honor them by casting a vote? Now, I know you go on to say that, you don't have to, you don't have to vote for a particular person. You can have a none of the above, but respond to the criticism about government coercion.
Look, if you're an absolute kind of Ayn Rand libertarian, and you think any form of government compulsion is wrong, you're not going to support universal voting. But if you think about it, there are many things that we do because that we are required to do, because it benefits the society and the community as a whole. So, obviously you have to pay taxes, but you also have to educate your children to the age of 16. You have to fill out the census. You have to serve on jury duty, which we also talked about. I don't want to trivialize it, but you also have to clean up after your dog, and nobody says, how dare they make me clean up after my dog? I think they probably did when it was first enacted. But our sidewalks are a lot safer as a result. Anyway, so I think the point is that there are required civic duties that every society imposes, and it's a matter of what the society gets used to. And the fact that no one says, how dare they compel me to serve on a jury, even though serving on a jury is a lot more work and a lot more effort and loss of income potentially than being required to vote, it's part of the culture and we accept it. So our hope is that 50 years from now, people will say, well, of course I'm going to vote. It's just what we do. It's how we work. It's how we roll in America. That's what we want to have heard. So that's one objection. There are several others that have been made that that I can respond to too, but let me get back.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say also that, and you have a whole chapter on the issue of the constitutionality, and it's a complex issue. Some say, you know, is it violates the First Amendment? Would it be coerced speech? You have a very careful chapter, which effectively argues that a carefully drawn statute you believe would pass constitutional muster.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of Supreme Court precedent that you cannot compel people to speak what is not on their mind. So you can't compel someone to pray in school. You can't compel someone to say the Pledge of Allegiance if they don't want to. But you can compel action. So the question is whether being required to cast a vote is speech or is it action? And our contention, not just me and EJ, but the constitutional scholars that were part of the working group who really looked at this closely, is that if you have the option to say none of the above, or cast a blank ballot, or deface the ballot if you really accuse, or write in someone else, then you are not compelled to speak in any particular way, that the act of participating is not speech. It is action, and you may speak any way you feel like speaking once you arrive at the polling place or put your ballot in the mail. So I think that is really true. The other argument that is made that we also dismiss kind of sharply is what's called in the academic circles the ignorant voter argument, which is that, oh, if you bring all these new people into the process, they're not going to study, they're not going to know the issues as well as people who vote frequently. And our view on that is that, you'd be hard pressed to make the case that people who are voting now, they're more ideological, they're more agitated, but they may not be more educated than people who have not been voting. So I think that's wrong. Plus, it's a fundamentally undemocratic argument and a slippery slope. You go back to the Jim Crow era where, people had to do literacy tests to prove that they were qualified to vote. And of course, those were, abused in the most awful and racist fashion. But I think the basic idea that we should decide who is kind of qualified to vote is an idea that we should dismiss. We want everybody to participate, and we will benefit from the fullest possible participation.
Right. Well, in your book, you talk about you acknowledge very frontally the fact that this proposal doesn't have a huge amount of public support now. About a quarter of the people respondents to a poll support it. Something like 65-66% don't. Your response is, this is a new idea. It's not really that surprising. The job of people like you and EJ and others is to educate people so that they understand the problem you're trying to solve and think about it in a different way.
That's exactly right. I mean, there was one interesting, EJ likes to say, we are either the most honest authors or the dumbest authors, because we include a whole chapter on a poll, the top line of which is that 26% of people support our idea, and therefore 74% either don't or are unsure. But there was one very interesting result in the question in the poll, which says, do you consider voting a right or a duty or both? And 61% of the people, both Republicans and Democrats, said that they considered voting both a right and a duty. And if something is a duty, again, you can make the argument that people should be required to do it. But the other thing is right, which is this is a brand new idea. Again, a brand new idea in the United States, hardly a brand new idea in much of the rest of the world. But almost all of Latin America, by the way, uses universal voting. And Chile, the country of Chile, just in December, the Chamber of Deputies voted 124-6 to instate or reinstate, actually, in the Chilean case, universal voting. So this is an idea whose time has arrived in many, many other places. But we have to, begin the argument. And we had two reactions. This is always interesting, to people hearing the idea for the first time. One is, wow, this is really interesting. Had never thought about it. Let me look into it, which was my reaction, okay? And then other people who say, this is complete pie in the sky. We're having a hard enough time holding on to the democracy that we have. And you guys are kind of imagining this, la-di-da future. But I would say I've been very encouraged. And I would say it's been two-thirds wow, this is really interesting, let's dig into it. And less than a third of people saying, you know, I'm really not interested, this is just way outside my sphere. And, you know, a really strong piece of evidence of that is actually in the state of Washington. And this is sort of hot off the press, but the Senate Majority Leader in the state of Washington actually read the book, sent it to the elections chair and said, I want to run a bill to require universal voting in the state of Washington. So there, a bill was submitted, an act establishing universal civic duty voting, with the preamble for the bill, or the first section of the bill, you know, taken pretty much right from the book. It has 14 Senate sponsors. It had a public hearing just last Tuesday, where I went out to Olympia and testified along with the Speaker of the Parliament of New South Wales in Australia. He was in by Zoom, I was in person. And the bill is now scheduled to come out of committee, you know, and be debated, you know, by the caucus and maybe by the entire floor of the Washington legislature. So again, this is from, you know, less than a year, as you pointed out, where the book has come out, where people have heard about it. And already there's a serious legislative effort in the state of Washington. And there's also going to be one in the state of Connecticut, where two bills have been filed that are going to be raised for a public hearing very shortly. So, you know, I think it's an indicator that, you know, when people have the idea and when they get a chance to think about it, either by reading the book or at least or by listening to an event like this today, you know, they start to think about it really differently. And that's what we have found. We have found many people who have come to the events that EJ and I did come up afterwards. Well, you know, we had the book signings and say, you know, I came in really, really skeptical, but this is really interesting. Either I'm convinced or I'm going to think about it more seriously or whatever. And we think that's real progress.
Well, this, I guess, dovetails where I want to go, which is just next steps for you. And, you know, obviously, I've seen you and EJ on a number of shows, and I've read reactions to your proposal. So I guess the first phase is to just stimulate a debate and to educate people and to put an idea into circulation that, as you say, has an international history, but maybe not so much of an American one. So I guess the first phase is to stimulate a debate. And I guess the second one is what you tipped off with Washington State is, do you want the focus to be primarily at the federal level, or do you want state and local entities to bandy it around and experiment with it and try it out in their jurisdictions?
Well, let me just go back to, given the good, generally quite good response to the book, we decided to create an organization. And as you mentioned, it's the organization itself is called 100% Democracy, an Initiative for Universal Voting. And we founded it just back in July, so we're just about 7 months old. And we have a three-part strategy. You mentioned two, but I'll say three. So the first is to, you know, socialize the idea and get it out through communication into the public debate. And we have a terrific, you know, communications group. Randy Brett is our director of communication, and she is fabulous. And we have other people. So that's the first, is to get the idea out and discussed. Second is that I believe, and I sort of come from what I would call a democracy movement. That is, there are lots of organizations and a growing number who are working towards a better democracy, whether it's about the Electoral College or money in politics or voting rights or voter registration. And what we want is for this idea of universal voting to become part of the agenda. So we're not saying to organizations, drop what you're doing, just work on this. But if you're already working on, you know, pre-registration of 16 and 17-year-olds, or a 16-year-old vote, which is happening, or if you're working on restoring voting rights to people with felony convictions, you know, also think about, you know, can we in a North Star kind of a way, a future kind of a way, look at universal voting. And then the third prong is to move it legislatively. And you raise an interesting question about the federal government. Yes, it could certainly be done at the federal level. And in fact, there has been a bill introduced at the federal level by Congressman John Larson of Connecticut, which is called the Civic Duty to Vote Act, HR 7536. But it's not gonna, you know, it's hard to imagine getting much traction in Washington the way it is now. So, but it is absolutely clear that states can do this. So what we're looking to do is find, you know, well, two states this year, maybe six or seven next year and in 2025. And it also is possible for it to be done municipally. Depending on the state law, you know, cities could adopt this. So for instance, St. Paul and Minneapolis in Minnesota, which has generally pretty good democracy laws, adopted ranked choice voting over the last few years and didn't require any kind of state permission. So St. Paul is actually a place that we're actually looking at to see whether there might be the possibility. I'm not sure what the Illinois laws are, you know, in this regard. So what we're looking at states, counties, and municipalities to be the kind of laboratories of democracy, as Justice Brandeis once said, to, you know, to try this out, and hopefully it expands from there.
Well, Miles, in your book, you write a lot and quite powerfully on what you call gateway reforms, which are steps to start taking now. And you've alluded to some of them, but there's a whole bundle of things in terms of just making it easier for people to register. Another kind of package is making it easier to just vote, to vote. Right. So talk about those two in particular.
Yeah. Well, the first point I'll acknowledge that if you were to impose a requirement for vote for everyone to vote on a system which makes it really hard for people to vote, that's a kind of oil and water situation, you know, would not work. So what we recognize and advocate for is that, you know, concomitant with beginning to discuss the idea of universal voting is that states and municipalities and the federal government, of course, should make it easier for people to vote. And we've made some real headway there. You know, voter registration opportunities have become much more widespread than they used to be. When I first became president of Demos, there were six states where you could register to vote on election day. Now there are 23. There are now 40 states where you can register to vote electronically. There's a number of states where you can pre-register for 16 and 17 year olds. So these are real, you know, and automatic voter registration where people go and they get their driver's license and they're automatically registered to vote. So that's all those things are things that we really want to need. And again, in Australia, 97% of all Australians are registered to vote because they have a very aggressive public education and public opportunity campaign. And in terms of voting, we've also, you know, give the COVID pandemic its credit as opposed to its, as in addition to its deep demerits, you know, we had made a lot of adaptations for allowing people to vote in the middle of a pandemic. So mail-in voting expanded dramatically. Washington, by the way, and Oregon, you know, are two states, and Colorado, where basically everybody votes by mail. So mail-in opportunities. Early voting, by the way, there were very few states that allowed people to vote other than on election day itself. And now actually 46 out of the 50 states allow people to vote early, whether it's 5 days early, or in some cases it can go up to 45 days early. So these reforms are all, you know, making it more possible to do it. And therefore, they make it more possible for us to say, yes, you are required to vote. It's not that hard. We've made it easy. So we support all of these reforms. I'm incredibly grateful to the organizations and the legislative leaders who have moved this forward. I'm incredibly non-grateful in those states where the legislatures are trying really, really hard to make it harder for people to vote, and shame on them. And by the way, I think it's important for that kind of, I hate to call it trench warfare because it sounds so ugly, but you know, we are engaged in a battle. Whether are we going to have more days of early voting or less? Are we going to have more difficult voter IDs required of people, or are we going to have less difficult? How are you going to be able to give people water when they're waiting online to vote or not? You know, all these things. And I think those are important fights to be done. But I also want people to look over the horizon and say, you know, beyond getting a few more additional days of early voting, is there something that can really, really change the dynamics of voting? And I think universal voting is that thing.
Well, I think one of the mantras of a progressive is the notion that ideas that now seem, you know, almost impossible or implausible, at a certain point, maybe seem like they will be inevitable. I mean, one point you make too is you know, a policy like, you know, climate change legislation, which California pioneered in the 70s, was sort of dismissed, has, you know, I mean, it created something that has come back decades later and has become a kind of guidance for federal policy. So again, another kind of reason for experimentation at the state and local levels to just show practically how this works and to give an idea, some momentum and kind of a track record.
Well, you know, a very interesting historical footnote here is that, you know, it wasn't until 1900 and just after 1900 that we had a secret ballot in America. Up until then, you know, people went to the polls with a ticket supplied by a political party telling them who to vote for. And the party observers were there to make sure that they voted for the people on the ticket. By the way, that's where the term ticket, when you're on a presidential ticket, that's where the term ticket came from, because you used to have an actual paper ticket that you would bring in. And the state of Australia and the country of Australia was the first to adopt a secret ballot in the 1880s and 1890s, and gradually it spread to the United States. And in fact, when it was first introduced in the United States, it was called the Australian ballot. So not only do we think that there are, you know, ideas that have to be, you know, put out there and then they pick up steam, we also have a good history of taking up good ideas from Australia. So I think this should be Australian idea number two.
Great. Miles, we have some questions that have been sent in.
Sure.
The first one, you made a glancing reference to it. It says, do you see a path to create, allow across the board voting rights and access to incarcerated individuals? Talk about, and I think you had maybe talked about people who had felony convictions and their voting status. Address that issue, if you would.
Thank you. Whoever asked the question, thank you. It's a very interesting question. And another question and another area where there's a tremendous variation from state to state. There are three places in the United States, Maine, Vermont, and Washington, D.C., where people never lose their right to vote, where there's actually a complete separation between your incarceration or your criminal liability and your voting rights. Okay. And that goes all the way negative. You know, that's the top of the chart. The bottom of the chart are places where you can never get your voting rights back. And frankly, we have made progress. There used to be half a dozen states where your right to vote was taken away forever. And these go back, these laws, by the way, just to be clear, go back to 1868 and 1870. They were at the beginning of the Jim Crow era, where basically you couldn't say that Black people couldn't vote, but you could arrest them on vagrancy charges and then say that people who were had criminal convictions couldn't vote. So this was, in fact, a way to keep Black people from voting back in the day. But we've made progress. But in terms of bringing it in here, so there are states that are all in between. Some states, when you get out of prison, you are eligible to vote. In some states, you have to get out of prison and also pay your fines, or also serve your probation, you know, so it's all over the map. So our view is that either we should adopt the Maine, Vermont, and Washington, D.C. model, and people should be allowed to vote when they're incarcerated. I would personally support that. Or at least go to what we would call the post-incarceration standard, which is once you get out of prison, regardless of whether you're on probation or regardless of whether you have financial obligations, whatever, once you are out of prison, you can vote. And that what that does means that someone goes to register, ipso facto, they are allowed to do so, and you would do it. So I am absolutely in favor of moving toward a much more liberal standard for people getting their voting rights back. So I appreciate the question.
Okay. I think you'll appreciate this question too, that this person asks, how, in addition to word of mouth, can I help you?
Well, you can start by going to our website, which is 100percentdemocracy.org. We have lots and lots of information there. I certainly wouldn't mind if you bought the book and read it, and then after you were finished with it, lend it to a friend. If you're a professor on a college campus, you can assign it in your courses. It's a very short book. It's very readable. But the basic idea is we are compiling a list of supporters. So if you go to the website, you can sign up. But to just start to talk about the idea, to learn about the idea and start to talk about it, and whatever state you're in, you know, there may be possibilities to, or even communities, there may be possibilities to move it. Again, we're at the very, very earliest stages of this. So it's not like go to your local 100% democracy chapter. We don't have those yet. Maybe someday.
Miles, two issues that your book raises that, interestingly, a number of our guests, when we talk about democratic reforms, bring up. And the first concerns the primary system. And I think we've had a half dozen guests who said that they think the single most pernicious force in terms of our polarization is our primary system, in which, you know, just the opposite of universal voting, you know, 32% of the people decide who your nominee is. And so you focus aggressively in on that small portion. Now, in your book, you mentioned, you acknowledge that, you know, your proposal does not pertain to primaries. You say every state has a different system. Talk about primary reform, and particularly maybe as a gateway reform. Is there something that could and should be done to change our primary system?
I think the answer is yes. We were a little hesitant to include primaries because there's so much so different in different states, and in some states the parties run them, so we had a hard time of saying require you to go to register for a party in order to do a primary vote. But I think there are a number of reforms about primaries. They have the in Alaska they adopted a kind of first past the post eliminating the first past the post primary, and the top four finishers went to the general election. That's a real possibility, and it does have, I do think that tends to lessen the extremes, lessen the power of the extremes on the right or the left in those situations. So I am for primary reform. I think I am for open primaries. I wasn't always. I used to think, honestly, that a political party should be able to nominate its own candidates, and allowing the other party or unaffiliated people to meddle in the party system. But I think the way it has turned out, has encouraged the kind of polarization we see. So I would support, the kind of top two primaries or top four primaries or top five primaries, et cetera. I also think ranked choice voting is important. Maine and Alaska have adopted ranked choice voting. In a way, it's a role model for us, because here was this idea that was hard to explain, actually much harder than universal voting. Universal voting is pretty easy to explain. And it was a kind of a fringe idea that only a few kind of good government, nerds were interested in. And gradually it expanded, and some cities adopted it, and now two states have adopted it, and now people are really talking about it in a significant way, and we hope that universal voting. And in Australia, by the way, I should say that they do have ranked choice voting. They call it preferential voting there. But what it means when you combine it with universal voting is that everybody's voting, and then secondly, everyone's vote is counted as they intended to be counted. Right, so you don't have the situation if you have ranked choice voting where you're voting for, your most favorite candidate, understanding that you might be helping your least favorite candidate. In ranked choice voting, your vote goes to your first choice, then your second choice, then your third choice, and it's counted as it should. So I think all those things are true. The one thing I do want to say though, is that universal voting is not a magic elixir for what ails our democracy. I mean, there are many, many other issues. The primary system, the party system is one. The electoral college, which completely disadvantages states with larger populations, is a second. The undemocratic nature of the United States Senate, where California and Illinois get two votes, and Wyoming, which has one 100th of the population or 150th, gets the same two votes in the United States Senate, and of course the money in politics, right? There's no question that, large donors, especially given the Supreme Court decisions over the last 50 years, have free rein to contribute and to dominate our political process. And that's a terrible and undemocratic thing. And again, universal voting won't solve that problem. But in the lane of full participation, which people have said, full voting participation is the antidote to the money in politics, to the domination of money, because people can overcome money if there are enough of them. I think in the lane of participation, this is really a kind of incredibly valuable and important and game-changing idea.
Well, give me your most hopeful scenario for, say, the next decade. I mean, how does this, I mean, this is a big idea. It's obviously going to take time. What, you know, what would be a really promising decade of progress for this idea in your mind?
Well, let me go back to my three prongs of our strategy. Because I think the first thing would be that it is one of the ideas, like ranked choice voting, like primary reform, like the Electoral College, where there's a real ongoing, seriously invested in public debate about whether it's a good idea or not. And right now we're just at the beginning of doing that. I mean, the state of Washington, the state of Connecticut are really the first places where this is being discussed in that way. So, and also, in terms of scholars, et cetera, I want to come back to an interesting example in a minute. But so to have it be just part of the dialogue in the journalist community and the academic community and the people who are doing this. Secondly, would be that for organizations, who I think are playing an incredibly important role in these things, to adopt this as part of their agenda. And again, there are maybe half a dozen that have done so already, but, many, many organizations. And then last, I guess I would say, I'd like to see kind of gradually somewhere between algebraic and geometric growth in the number of states. So I'd like to see, to be honest, so 2025, 2024, for many legislatures are short sessions, or they're only supposed to be about budgets. It's complicated. But I would like to see that by the 2025 sessions, there might be 7 or 8 states where there are serious discussions going on. And maybe even, a couple of states where by 2027, this idea actually gets adopted. And I'd like to see, a dozen or so cities that adopt it, because again, I think it's really something that would change. A very interesting theory, by the way, from comes from Professor Nick Stephanopoulos, who's a Harvard law professor, is that if cities in purple, let's take a purple state. Well, let's take Illinois, that if somehow Chicago were to adopt universal voting, and instead of a 50% turnout in a gubernatorial election, it had a 90% turnout in a gubernatorial election, that would dominate the statewide elections. And if I were out in the non-Chicago part of the state, and I didn't want Chicago to have such a terribly disproportionate influence, well, I might adopt universal voting for Skokie as well. So my hope is that it gets a hold in cities or in counties, and then it spreads out from there. I think the first places will be places that generally have good current laws. Washington does, Maine, which is another place that we're looking at, does, et cetera. But I'd like to see this adopted in some places, discussed in far more, and just be part of that conversation. That's a good goal for the next 5 years or so.
Right. Well, let me ask you finally, Miles. I mean, you've had this remarkable career, community activist, elected official. You run some really important groups, Demos and Common Cause. You're involved in this, important and creative new effort. For students out there who are listening to this, what kind of advice would you give them about organizing their careers? I mean, what have you learned in the course of your wide-ranging, interesting career that you wish you knew when you were 22 years old, or that you'd like, that you would encourage a younger person to think about as they prepare to launch their careers?
That's a really good question. Well, I'd say a couple of things. One is, I think I benefited enormously by starting as a grassroots organizer, because it was my job to talk to ordinary people and to listen to what their lives were like, to listen to how they thought about issues, et cetera. I think people who go straight from an elite college to running for the state legislature and Congress or whatever, they miss out on something, that is really to have a kind of a real heartfelt understanding about what people's lives are about. I think that's really important. So I would encourage people to start, doing some work with real people. And the other thing I would say, which is very hopeful, is that I think it's entirely possible to make a career in social change. Used to be, well, am I going to go into business and make money, or am I going to go become a kind of community organizer and live in a miserable apartment for the rest of my life? I don't think that's the choice. you know, there's a lot of organizations out there who are doing really good work, who are professionalizing, who are paying more money as salary, who are having 401k plans. Many of them are having unions now, so their wages are raising. So I think that it's possible to really be in the field of social change or democratic reform and have a good and rewarding life. And the other thing, going back to the various phases that I mentioned of my own career, is that there's no one way. You know, we used to argue about who's the true revolutionary, who's really making the change. And if you're not doing this, then you're not doing it right. No such thing. You know, if you have an academic bent, there are ways in which academics can have incredibly important impact. If you are drawn to being an elected official, I think you can be a really, really important and good election official. And if you want to just be an organizer, you can do that. And frankly, these days, if you want to be a corporate person, there's plenty of movement in the corporate world towards CSG or ESG, rather, environmental, social, and I can't remember what the G is, but it'll come back to me. So anyway, I think there's lots of ways to do it. What I have found, because I'm in touch with a lot of the people that I went to school with still 50 years later, is that they had different career paths, but when they started out as someone with a real social conscience and a real activist conscience, they found a way, whether they were psychiatrists or lawyers or, you know, engineers or whatever it was, to contribute to the greater good. And I have very few regrets about my own career, but one of the things that I feel best about is that I have managed to go for, you know, going on 55 years now, always in the fight for a better world. And they also say that one of the best ways to age, the two biggest things about aging well, not that you guys are like, you know, and gals are here yet, is number one, to be involved in your grandchildren's life. And number two, to have something that you do that it occupies and that you care deeply about. And I feel blessed to be in both of those situations.
Great. Well, Miles, thank you for a terrific conversation. I've heard all about you a lot over the years. We have a good friend, Randy Brett, who speaks your praises and put me on to this book. And it's a really important and interesting idea. And I know that at the Institute, we're trying to find ways to revive and revitalize our democracy. So I encourage our viewers to take a look at Miles' book. I read it on an airplane, so it's very readable, easy to digest. I recommended it to a couple of my fellow passengers, so hopefully I boosted your sales a little bit, Miles. But again, I think it's an important idea that we'd love to hear more about as the years unfold. So thanks so much for joining us, Miles.
And Jack, thank you for having me. And thanks to all the people who are listening in. Delighted to be in conversation with you. So thanks.
Thank you for listening to SimonCast, the official podcast of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University. SimonCast is produced in collaboration with WSIU Public Radio. You can find SimonCast wherever you listen to podcasts, including NPR One, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and more. Please subscribe to new episodes as soon as they're posted and tell your friends about our show. For more information, visit paulsimoninstitute.org. Thank you for listening, and thank you for keeping the legacy of Paul Simon alive and well.